It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfworth. For today's show, I tried to understand the solstice. And I mean, really understand it. Not just the simple version of the Earth tilts back and forth. Well, I did my best, and I hope you'll enjoy my confusion as part of our celebration of the shortest day of the year as the sun returns to northern skies. That's our first segment. Then I'm going to go check in with Mike Woods of the Susitna River Coalition. Mike and his neighbors banded together to protect their wilderness lifestyle from a proposal to build a dam on the Susitna. That idea seems to be dead, but the neighbors are still working together. I'll find out why. Later, we'll hear a piece on winter scuba diving, and in the second half of the show, get into gun safety. We spent a lot of time on shooting and hunting. Today, we're going to look at the public health aspects of guns, which is all about keeping them locked up at home. And to finish up, a funny story about what happens when you shoot your bear spray in the wrong direction at yourself. That's all coming up on Outdoor Explorer, Alaska Public Media's audio outdoor magazine. So it's our solstice edition of Outdoor Explorer. We just happen to be playing, and of course the show will be replayed, but the first time it's being played is on the solstice, the beautiful dark day of December 21st, 2017. Solstice does exactly fall on the 21st this year, and it's a time for celebration. You know, it's a midwinter kind of time when the sun is starting to come back, and it's a hopeful day, and it's also a velvety dark night. And I have a solstice expert with me in the studio to talk about it. Omega Smith is the manager of the UAA Planetarium and Visualization Theater. And do you celebrate solstice? Do you think it's a cool time of year?
Oh yeah. I mean, I celebrate solstice more as an Alaskan than as an astronomer. It's been something I've done like every year since I can remember up here.
Yeah, yeah. And in terms of as a astronomer, you get some extra dark sky. That must be nice.
It is really nice. Yeah, extra long dark skies.
Yeah, so which are good for seeing the aurora. This is a good time to see the aurora, though that usually happens around midnight anyway, right?
Well, aurora kind of happens whenever it feels like.
Mm-hmm.
When the darkest it is the best time to see it, but luckily it's going to be very dark for a very long time.
Yeah, yeah. So at the planetarium, are you doing any kind of discussion or marking of this date?
Well, our planetarium show about the solstice called Tilted Solstice was actually going to be last Friday.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have a show coming up tomorrow. It's called Above Alaska. So we talk about the aurora, and I'll be giving a little bit of a star show at the end of that. And we'll talk a little bit more about the solstice there, too.
Yeah. So the planetarium's open to the public. And it's right there on campus, and you put shows on pretty often, and people should come out because it's a really fun and great little facility.
Yeah, every Friday night we have public shows except for the first Friday of the month, and they're at 6:30 and 8 o'clock.
Okay, and the fee?
It's $5 for UAA students and children and $10 for adults.
Okay, so let's talk about what the solstice actually is. I guess it happens at a certain time during the day, which it strikes me as odd because I think of it as a day. How does that work? What time is the absolute solstice this year?
So the actual solstice will be at 7:28 a.m., which technically for us will still be nighttime because mm-hmm. the sun doesn't rise until about 10:14. But it is an astronomical event, so it doesn't take the whole day to happen. What happens is the Earth has a tilt, and so our North Pole will actually be pointing the furthest away at that one time throughout the whole entire year from the sun. And that's what the solstice is. It only happens for a brief moment before we start rotating around the Earth some more and getting our North Pole tilted back towards the sun.
So that's the exact moment when the Earth gets the farthest over and is ready to come back, which seems so mysterious, right? I mean, from our perspective as Earthlings, that seems like, wow, how does that? Is there a spring or something? What's happening? But it's just because the mass of the object is turning and it doesn't only spin, it sort of wobbles back and forth. Just like a top or something else. And so the motion is all built into the momentum of the Earth as an object, right?
Yeah, well, the tilt actually is what causes the solstice. So the tilt mm-hmm. pretty much stays the same. It does do something called precession, which wobbles mm-hmm. like a top. That takes 15,000 years.
Okay.
So we don't notice that within 1 year, but the tilt specifically.
But I mean, it tilts back this way and it tilts back that way. And is that because of the way we're going around the sun? Or what explains the fact that the Earth tilts back and forth on the pole?
Well, the poles actually stay the same. Mm-hmm. Earth just moves position. So mm-hmm. the pole will always be pointed the same direction. And like for us, it's pointed towards the North Star. So it's uh-huh. always going to be pointed that way. But as we evolve around the Earth, about 6 months later, the pole is actually pointed more towards the sun. And so that brings us the summer solstice.
And that's because of the orbit isn't like 100% parallel to the sun. It's a little bit above and below. Is that how?
Yeah. So our equator, it's something called the celestial equator. So you take Earth's equator and move it all the way out into the solar system. Mm-hmm. It's tilted compared to the ecliptic, which is kind of the plane of the sun and the planets. So because of that difference, that's what gives us seasons. And we see that in other planets as well.
But they have different seasons. It could be much longer or shorter or whatever, just based on how they happen to be orbiting.
Yes, exactly.
Huh. Well, I've just displayed my ignorance. I didn't realize that was how it worked. It's pretty cool. So it's really where we are in our path around the sun, which is determining this. And that's almost even more poetic, isn't it? Like this yeah. journey we're making an annual journey around the sun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which doesn't match up with our days exactly. It's 365.25
yeah,
something.
So there's a little extra quarter of a day uh-huh. compared to our calendar year.
Is that why the solstice would tend to change a little bit?
That's one of the reasons why, yes. Yeah, so it changes not very often. It usually lies within the same amount of like 24 or 48 hours. Mm-hmm. And it just depends on basically, one, your place on Earth. So if you're in a different spot on Earth, your hours are different. So it could be happening on the 20th. Or, what the position of Earth is around the sun and the extra
yeah.
part of the day. Yeah.
So here in Anchorage, what's the shortest the day gets? I don't know if you know that off the top of your head. You seem to know everything, so I'm going to throw it at you without warning.
I'm good at memorizing these things. So on the solstice, the 21st, the sun's going to rise at 10:14, and it's going to set at 3:41. So we're just under 5.5 hours of daylight.
Wow. That's not very long. So that's local time, which is kind of skewed, right? Our time isn't really lined up with where it would be if we didn't have time zones.
Yeah, exactly.
Which kind of skewed, like as if we were farther east or farther west. I mean, if people don't know, I mean, if we were truly on time for our celestial time, the sun would be directly overhead at noon, but it's not, because in order to have time zones where it's the same time across a broad span of the surface of the Earth, we kind of cheat a little bit.
Yeah, and Alaska has like one time zone.
We're really stretched.
Yeah, we are.
So how far off are we, do you know?
I think our noon is supposed to be around 12:45, so we're only about 45 minutes off.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a bit.
Yeah, it's enough to make a difference.
So what will you do? Would you celebrate the solstice? I know I'm going to a solstice party, which is being held the previous weekend. I guess people don't want to party on a Thursday night, though that would be the appropriate thing if we were like druids or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Are you going to be celebrating?
Absolutely. I'm going to be doing a good old-fashioned bonfire uh-huh. and some stargazing, hopefully. Hopefully you have clear skies.
Yeah, I think that to be outdoors with a bonfire seems very appropriate. And supposedly, these kinds of midwinter celebrations are one reason why we celebrate Christmas at this time of year, because nobody really knows the exact date that Christ, as a historical figure, was born. But there were celebrations for the solstice and for the returning of light that were joyful and were, you know, marking this kind of time of year that matched up with what the Christians wanted to do, and they kind of took over the holiday, or so I understand.
Yeah, it's actually, you can see it across almost every culture, that almost every culture since they started writing down their history has celebrated the solstice.
Because it's a very obvious thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, actually, because the word solstice actually means the sun stands still. Hmm. And so you kind of can't notice the change in sunlight within a couple of days of the solstice. But then as soon as that ends, you see like we gain minutes upon minutes of daylight, especially in northern latitudes.
Mm-hmm. If you go farther north, then, of course, it's going to be dark all day long.
Yes.
And that is, I guess, where the Arctic Circle lies, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's why we call it the Arctic Circle.
Yes, exactly. And that also has to do with our tilt of the Earth. So the Arctic Circle is due to the 23.4 degree tilt.
Okay. So if you just kind of have to imagine a ball, and if it's tipped over 23.4 degrees and the light is coming from underneath it to that degree, then on that line, even though you travel all the way around, you're always going to be in shadow of the rest of the Earth.
Exactly.
Right. But as I understand it, if you actually are on the physical Arctic Circle, you're not going to get a full day of darkness because there'll be a sort of refraction of sun over the horizon and you'll still get hit a little bit.
Yeah. So the atmosphere does actually refract some of the light.
And so, but you probably won't be much.
Yeah, I don't think it'll be very noticeable. Probably a dim glow.
You're not going to be reading the newspaper outside. Yeah. Now, if you're down on the equator, these things are much less noticeable, right?
Yeah, they are.
The length of the day is pretty much the same all year.
Pretty much, yeah. So it's not very noticeable. In fact, their sun will be up high. They'll have about 8 hours of sunlight, a little less. But once you get closer to the poles, you really notice a difference. Like if you go even further south, they're having their summer solstice. And so they'll get plenty of daylight down there.
Yeah. So why is it that the number of minutes that we gain of sunlight after the solstice seems to change? And my sense is that it goes up slowly, and then as you get nearer the equinox, which is halfway in between the summer and winter solstice, then it's bigger amounts each day. Is that right? Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah. So, the solstices tend to have the sun move slower when it changes in height. And then, as soon as the solstice is over, it makes a pattern in the sky called an analemma. And it's going to be very difficult to describe over the radio. That's why I love having a planetarium.
Yeah.
But if you can just imagine kind of a figure eight that's a little skewed, so the top part of the loop is a little small and the bottom part of the loop is a little bigger. So the winter solstice is going to be at the very bottom of that bottom loop. And so the next couple of days are going to be at the bottom, so it's not going to be much gain in sunlight. But as it starts turning up that bottom loop, it starts going higher and higher up in the sky, even faster. And then we get to the equinox, and it keeps going until all the way to the summer solstice.
And that's when at the equinox is when we're gaining the most light.
Yeah.
Most rapidly. And that's probably why spring explodes the way it does a little bit, huh?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. Is the equinox the same thing, that it's always close to the exact same place in the year every year?
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's just like the same astronomical event, except if you imagine the celestial equator again compared to the ecliptic plane, that's right when they meet. So that's right when the sun will be shining on both hemispheres of Earth at the exact same amount.
So essentially, and again, we're doing on radio what we should be doing with a model or something, but the Earth is riding around on its orbit around the sun, and sometimes that orbit is going kind of below it's sort of going down below the sun, and sometimes it's going up above the sun. I mean, there's no below or above in space, but I'm just trying to, with respect to our pole. And then on the equinox, we're right in line. So our equator is lined up perfectly with where the sun is hitting us. And that's when the day is the same. Am I getting it right?
Not quite.
Okay. I knew it. I'm really glad you're here, because we're going to work through this before we're done with this interview.
So the tilt of Earth kind of stays the same. And it doesn't really go higher up or lower down in the ecliptic plane that much. But what happens is the celestial equator, again, the Earth's equator stretched out, never really lines up with the ecliptic. It just kind of intersects it at one point. So when it intersects, that is the equinoxes. And when it's furthest away, those are the solstices.
All right. Well, folks, you're going to have to go to the planetarium with my guest, Omega Smith, to really get this explained.
It's much easier to explain in a
planetarium. And you've got stargazing events, and you do all kinds of stuff over there. I'm sure you have a website with some of the events.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll have that posted at outdoorexplorer.org, so you can find out about all this cool stuff you can learn about the night sky. So thank you so much for being here, Omega.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right. Stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues. Charles Wolfworth here on Outdoor Explorer. And on the phone with me right now from Talkeetna, I have Mike Woods, who is the president of the Susitna River Coalition. The Coalition is a group that fought the Wantana Dam, the big dam that was planned for the Susitna River for many years, seems to have finally bit the dust. And one of the things I wanted to ask Mike was, why still have the Coalition, you know, if there's no more dam? But I also just kind of wanted to learn about his lifestyle and what it's like up there. Mike is in Talkeetna right now, which is sort of the big city for his area up there. He lives off the railroad tracks in Chase, you know, in really, really remote country. And it's kind of the true Alaskan lifestyle. Thanks a lot for being with us, Mike.
Oh, you're welcome, Charles. Thanks for asking.
So tell me how the Susitna River Coalition got going and what it was all about. Am I correct that it was a group of locals who were worried about the flooding and the other threats that dam would create?
Yeah. I mean, it was created totally by locals and supported by locals. And the creation was back in July of 2011, right after Parnell came out with the Governor Parnell at the time came out with the announcement that they were going to revive the Susitna-Watonna project once again. And at that point, especially the folks of Talkeetna, where this project would have been about 80 miles upriver from the town, really started to activate. And it was a great local and grassroots effort taken on by retired school teachers and bush rats and business owners, just a bunch of people that got together and were like, hey, it was originally Coalition for Susitna Dam Alternatives. And it was like, the philosophy was we don't need this massive hydroelectric project. There are a lot of other better ways to generate power that are better for Alaska, way more economical, and better for rural areas, which, you know,
yeah,
was going to help us, especially here in Chase. So,
well, I know as the state ran out of oil money, a lot of these mega projects just died of their own massiveness, and probably we never could have built them all anyway because there were so many being pursued at the same time. But I guess you guys had a different. You guys weren't really focused so much on the money, although I'm sure that was a good argument, but you're focused more on what it would do to the river. And I guess that was largely a salmon issue, right?
It was, but, you know, it's hard. Everybody wants to come at it from a very passionate level, which is about the environment. But one thing that I think we did well with is we tried to base it very much on the economics. Like the project never made financial sense. It wasn't needed by the state, and in the long term, it would really devastate a thriving economy up here, which is built on tourism and an awesome free-flowing river, and the fish that support the communities from Cook Inlet all the way up into the Eastern Alaska Range, so and through Unit 13 hunting area. So, I mean, it was the economic impacts would have been massive, but, you know, coming from a place where, you know, I live on the river every day, I can very much imagine the impacts of 730 to 80-foot concrete dam would have had on the river in front of my house.
Yeah. Well, tell me about where you live and what your lifestyle is like. Obviously you're very passionate about it and you really fought hard to protect it successfully this time. What's your life like up there, and what's so special about it that you wanted to protect?
Well, it's very free form, I have to say. My wife has a great job, and she's able to work from home and travel abroad. At the same time, I work in the woods, logging, milling the logs, moving log homes or building log homes, and in the spring, I go down to the mouth of the Susitna and begin fishing a commercial set net permitting that I have down there at the mouth of the Susitna. And I do that most of the summer. And then I come back up in the fall and start hunting up here because all that we have in our freezer is from what we find here on the river, both bears and moose and caribou. And, when Molly and I came up here, this Susitna River in particular was really, really spoke to us. And we didn't necessarily think we'd live off the road system, but in the end, there was no other choice. This is what we loved. And so we bought some parcel on the river and logged all the logs for our house. And I hand-dug the well, which is like 28 feet deep. That was ridiculous.
Wow.
I've dug everything around here. Yeah, yeah, I'm just really good with a shovel. And I think, you know, prior to this, I was a mountaineering guide on Denali and for about 15 years. And that, you know, that gives you a lot of experience shoveling, you know.
So. That's right. It sounds glamorous, but it's actually about shoveling, yeah.
Yeah, it's really a lot of shoveling and melting ice into water, yep.
Right. Well, that sounds like, for somebody who loves the outdoors, it sounds almost idyllic to be out there and kind of be, you know, the like you're saying, the bush rat, the nature boy, without ever having to punch a clock. And then this issue comes along and you end up having to kind of emerge and take it on and really enter sort of that whole world that you've gotten away from.
It really did. And, you know, what got me pulled into it was originally, I mean, my desire to, I mean, the impacts of these mega hydro projects are so well known around the world now. And I just felt like there's no way that this could happen without having significant impacts on this river and that we have. And on top of that, I started working with the scientists that were here. I got pulled in by a hydrologist. And really nice guy, and he wanted me to help show him how to travel safely on the river, show him where the fish were, and I very much enjoyed that. And but as time went on, it became clear that unfortunately there was more behind this than science. I thought that if the science, you know, if they could see how this river worked on all levels, they'd realize it would be impossible to dam it and not completely mess it up. And finally, I was too torn. My voice was, I could no longer continue working for the scientists. And I had to go full bore into the Susitna River Coalition. And but I still supported the science and very much. And that's what the Susitna River Coalition has done throughout this whole process, is we've been very engaged in the science and the whole Federal Energy Regulatory Commission process that started this whole thing. And in fact, we're still very engaged in that. You mentioned that the dam is dead, but actually it was only because we wrote a letter about two summers ago now with the signatures of 11,000 Alaskan members of our coalition asking the governor to shut this project down. And now we're at 14,000 members today, and we're super proud of that, just all Alaskans from around the state and even some from out of state, but 14 from within the state. And, you know, in 1986, the state wrote a letter requesting to FERC that they end the process, and that was the second time they had studied the Susitna Hydro Project. And
this is number three that we've just finished then, huh?
Right, exactly, yeah. And now that the governor, he got that letter, he responded by making the announcement that he's going to put the project on hold, and he actually wrote a letter asking for an abeyance, which is basically just, we're going to stop this project for now.
Oh.
But he actually has not written the letter to terminate the project officially. So we are still here in part to monitor where this is going, because if the money came back and if, you know, it was desired, it's something that they could fan the coals of.
Right.
And bring it back if they wanted.
So you kind of feel like you need to remain vigilant at this point.
That's a big part of it. You know, but the other part is we all really want to be proactive rather than just reactive fighting. And that's a big part of what we started with this whole thing. I mean, just it brings into question how energy in around Alaska is transported via power lines, how it's created. You know, we quickly realized that there's enough energy being created out there now, and the state really lacks an ability to move that electricity around the rail belt. And I should say just the rail belt, not the state. I'm sorry. But at any rate, so efforts, we've been really engaged in that. Hopefully that, you know, REAP will have some influence on that. Chris Rose's.
The Renewable Energy Alaska project out in Palmer. Yeah.
Right, right. We're very supportive of there being an independent system operator to help, you know, move the energy around better. And
wow, that sounds like from fishing and hunting, you're now figuring out energy transfer systems and all that. You know, it takes.
Well, you know, part of living in the woods is you got to be able to like dive into anything and fix it. You know what I mean?
I guess so.
Or your water system, or you know, all of a sudden your fishing boat starts to sink. You better move fast.
So are you on the grid out there? Do you get power from the grid, or do you like have solar, or how do you get your electricity, if any?
Yeah, we have solar out here. We've got a 24-volt system, and throughout the leaner months when we're not getting so much sun, I've got a 9 kW diesel generator that I power my shop, which I work inside on projects, welding and woodworking projects, and it also charges the batteries. So, you know, I know what it's like to also have to be really reliant on fossil fuels. You know, when you live in the woods, you don't say goodbye to those things.
You're hauling diesel, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I get it, you know. So it's a balance for everything, and trying to do it the best way we can. One way I use my generator out there is I use all the off heat to heat my shop, and so I try really hard to maximize and be thoughtful about how things work, so my impact isn't too massive.
Yeah, sounds like you're really your local. You're thinking global and acting local as much as you can. I wonder if you, just in terms of where we're going, in these big dams and hydro projects, you know, a few years ago, people talked about Susitna-Wetana as being, you know, the key to Alaska decarbonizing, you know, and getting rid of our fossil fuel use for electricity, and that we were going to, you know, help the global warming fight. And I know that's a little bit... you know, that's a little bit complicated by the methane that dams release and so forth, and that's not a simple issue at all. But I also kind of wonder if maybe that the big mega project is the thing of the past, and actually the future decarbonizing is going to be distributed generation and you know, like your little solar panels up there, and maybe small hydro and in-stream hydro and that kind of thing.
You know, that's a great question. I mean, after the whole Fukushima quake, I think they realized that having centralized energy and was difficult, and having it more distributed around the entire system of Japan was a better way to go. And more, I mean, Alaska is the perfect example of all these small communities that really could benefit from, you know, that kind of energy generation for them wherever they live. I mean, even on the road system, people like in Tokyo and whatnot depend so much on they have such large bills because it's diesel-generated power, and we're very supportive. I personally am really supportive of any kind of project in those areas that supports those, you know,
those ideas.
The energy cost.
Yeah. So tell me about your coalition, and when you've got your little piece of paradise there, and it's just sitting in a valley so abundant and wild. Are there any other looming threats that you're worried about, or do you feel like now assuming that this one is really dead, which I guess is still a little bit of a question mark, do you feel like Susitna Valley is in pretty good shape?
You know, I can't live here and take advantage of it. It would be easy to bury my head in the mud out here.
Yeah.
But, you know, I live a mile from the Alaska Railroad. I'm sandwiched between that and the Susitna River. There's a lot of tourism going on. You know, I know the state needs economic development, and it needs to be done really super responsibly. And, you know, for me and for this area, fishing is a major way of life. And in the Mat-Su, our tourism industry has been hammered hard by the lack of king salmon up here. And, you know, the cohos, the silvers returning, it's been a little difficult. And, you know, the Susitna River has some issues And Cook Inlet has some issues regarding the fish. And energy, you know, the grid that goes between, the intertie that goes between Fairbanks and Anchorage is right here, not far from me, and I hunt along it. And I can't not pay attention to these things and right now, and I've had to get more active. But people recognize that. This isn't about me, and that's why the coalition is so cool. It's really made up of many people like me that live rurally or not, that recognize the importance of the Susitna River that flows right in their backyard. You know, the community of Willow has so many people leaving from Deshka Landing to travel out across the Susitna River and down onto the Yentna. And, I mean, it's just a massive highway for those, for people, summer and winter. And so it's just something that we're forced to have to take care of and not oppose everything. I mean, that, one of the nice things about there not being the looming effect of a hydro project is that we can be really proactive. And, you know, environmental groups get quoted as always being anti. And I very much have tried to steer clear of that and just provide alternatives and options and solutions that are thoughtful. And you don't trade one resource for another.
Yeah,
and
that's great.
Can't get rid of, yeah, that's pretty much.
That's a great vision, and you know, you're taking responsibility for where you live, and people might disagree with you, but they can't help but think it's a great lifestyle you have, and that you're fighting for is a terrific thing. And I really thank you for being on with us. Mike Woods, president of the Susitna River Coalition. We caught him in Talkeetna. We're pre-recording this interview. He actually lives up off the grid in Chase, accessible, you know, by snow machine or railroad and that sort of thing. Thanks a lot for being with us, Mike.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks, Charles. I appreciate the opportunity to hopefully speak on behalf of all our members. And thanks for realizing that we're still alive and kicking.
Still out there. All right. Stick with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
For our next segment, we're staying with water, but going from the Susitna River to Summit Lake in the mountains south of Anchorage, where Alaska Public Media's India Alaska team met up with author, biologist, and adventurer Bill Strever to go diving underneath the ice. You can see video from this piece on our site at outdoorexplorer.org. It was created by Travis Gilmore and John Norris.
I can go out in the forest, climb mountains, go hiking, go skiing in the winter, and enjoy being outside, enjoy being in nature. But going underwater gives me a whole new world to look at. We're in beautiful Summit Lake, Alaska, at about 1,300 feet, roughly halfway between Seward and Anchorage. It's ice diving season, so we've got a hole cut in the ice. So we're looking at about 18 inches or so of ice right now. And the ice underneath is very smooth and very clear. The ice closer to the surface has snow entrained with the ice, so it's white and it's opaque. It's almost like looking through a very, very thick piece of glass with some white translucent filters behind it. And in that thick piece of glass, you see things like bubbles. And as the ice thickens, it keeps trapping more and more bubbles over weeks and weeks of time. Really interesting to look at from underneath. My diving history goes way back. I learned to dive when I was, 14 years old, and I was diving in lakes in Georgia that had terrible visibility, nothing to see, and I loved every minute of it. Well, diving in Alaska is a lot better than diving in Georgia, I'll give it that. Diving in Georgia is called, I call it desperation diving. You're only doing it to get underwater. So everybody comes from all over the world. They come to Alaska to see our mountains, to see our wildlife. Another side of that is to see our diving, because we really do have fantastic diving in the state of Alaska. This is the longest I've ever lived anywhere. I feel, you know, everybody wants to say I'm an Alaskan. I guess you're not truly an Alaskan unless you were born here, and I wasn't born here, but I'm at home in Alaska. My son Ish, or Ishmael, he came to Alaska when he was only about 4 years old. I'm a big fan of the book Moby Dick, and it means a lot to me because Ishmael was sort of this seagoing philosopher constantly reflecting about life and having adventures with Captain Ahab and the Great White Whale. And I spend a lot of time thinking about how I'm next going to get out on my next adventure, I suppose you would say. Ish sees himself as a big city kid. And you know, it's interesting, he's never lived in the big city, but he sees himself as a big city kid and he would love to move to New York or to Chicago or LA. I definitely think Alaska can be a very tough place for kids, especially kids that are not real enamored with the outdoors. He's his own man. I think he needs to do what's right for him, just like I did what's right for me.
When you're ready.
More than anything else, I think I'm afraid of getting into a routine existence. It's just too easy to stop trying to do different things and to fall into a routine of a kind of a 9-to-5 job or something like that. But I've seen that in other people that I care about, other people that I know, my parents, for example, and I don't want my life to go that way. I think if you're spending a lot of time sitting around worrying about whether or not you're happy, you're probably not. You know, it's more something that comes to you without trying. And if you're trying, it's just probably means that something's missing. Alaska is kind of a blue-collar state. For some people, that translates into a redneck state: snow machines and guns and beer. But that's definitely not the full truth. I actually find Alaskans to be very open-minded and generally very thoughtful people and also very well-educated people. Come here and spend a summer, spend a winter if you can. Get to know Alaska, get to know the people, spend a lot of time outdoors. It will change your life.
That piece was from Alaska Public Media's Indie Alaska Project. You heard Alaska author and biologist Bill Strever. I'm Charles Woolforth. Stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. Well, we read about a really terrible tragedy that happened recently with a 5-year-old in Anchorage who died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound, a gun that had not been properly secured in the home. And we talk a lot about shooting sports on the show, from biathlon to duck hunting and big game hunting and skeet and target and everything else. And I know a lot of our listeners are gun owners. But we haven't really talked about the safety part of it and the fact that obviously guns are very dangerous, especially around kids, and we really want to be careful with them. So to have that discussion and to make sure we're being, you know, thoughtful and respectful about all this, I have Eric Boyer with me in the studio, and he comes from a health perspective. He's with the Center for Human Development at the College of Health at University of Alaska Anchorage. And Eric has been talking about securing guns, gun safety, the things that are necessary to keep your family safe when you have guns, safe from the guns. Thanks for being here, Eric.
Yes, thank you, Charles. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start out by just saying, like, why is this a health issue? How does it fall into your hands to be thinking about this issue?
Well, if you think about health in a community perspective, we look at it from what we call a public health perspective. And in a public health perspective, the idea is that every citizen has a role they can play to support each other. And I think gun safety falls right in there. Many of us practice some of those things that we've been taught or we've learned about securing and keeping guns safe or other weapons. But it's the kind of thing that if you think about Alaska and some of the western states, it can be a real touchy subject. So it's really important for us to bring this up, whether we're talking about it with our family members, coworkers, colleagues, our neighbors. And simple things can come up where somebody is keeping and storing a weapon that they think is secure, but it's not really secure when, you know, possibly a neighbor or a younger person could wander in and find something that we don't think that is possible, but it does happen.
Yeah.
And it's a relatively rare event for an accident like that, but when it does, it has a really devastating, profound impact on citizens in the community as a
horribly
whole.
Horribly so, so part of it is securing guns in the home so that they are essentially inaccessible to somebody who shouldn't be getting them.
Yes.
And I think most of our outdoor-oriented listeners are using their guns for sport of some kind, not for planning to shoot somebody who comes into the house, which is an incredibly rare thing.
It is.
Yeah. So you're from a safety perspective, if your gun is locked up, you're much safer than if you've got it like under your pillow.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, you think about, you know, Alaska, if you ask the Alaska State Troopers, their data show that, you know, we have, what, over 700,000 people in Alaska, and the average Alaskan has 3.17 guns. Well, you think about probably about 30% of Alaskans don't even own a gun. So that means many of us have a lot more than 3.17. Yep. So there's a lot of guns out there. It's a part of our culture. It's a part of who we are in Alaska for a lot of reasons, sporting and harvesting food for the table, which is great. But in that process, if you think about the home, this is kind of where the focus is. The majority of accidental occurrences with guns, suicides, homicides, they happen in the home. And so that's why keeping guns not just secure, but physically talking about how we lock them up with a lock, gun safe, storing the ammunition separately. And those seem counterintuitive to some people that are worried about home safety. But those kind of things are such rare events that in case that somebody's using a gun for that purpose, it's probably not going to make a difference anyway. Mm-hmm. So it's really important that those things are safe and secure. And it really, you know, it limits some of those opportunities when somebody is not feeling safe or they're feeling apprehensive about their own life, struggling with depression, maybe using substances, or it's somebody who is just wanting to investigate guns and they're checking something out in the home.
Because this is where the accidents happen. And
that's
kind
where
of
they
setting.
Happen.
Yeah. So when you talk about sort of what are the basics for the gun needs to be under lock and key some way or other, or there's some specific ways you feel are best.
Yes. And so if you think about like a two lock system, you know, locks for guns, you know, they have extended lock so that they can go through the receiver, through the magazine, through the actual barrel of the gun.
Which is like a almost like a bicycle lock.
Yes, it is. And it's a flexible kind of metal, you know, cord that goes through. Mm-hmm. And getting those locks shouldn't be a barrier. That's why you can get them for free. There's if you go online, you can go to it's called projectchildsafe.org.
Okay, we'll get that. We'll make sure that's on outdoorexplorer.org so folks can find it.
That'll be great because it lists the different police departments and the state troopers in Alaska that provide free locks, gun locks. The VA provides free. So it's not to be a barrier. The VA, you can actually go on to the va.org. You can go in and order locks, and they will mail them to you.
Oh, obviously, wow.
Yeah, and it's free. Obviously, our tax dollars are at use there.
Yeah.
But I think it's responsible use of our tax dollars.
Yeah. Okay.
And so you
and
lock
when you
those.
Say double lock, lock it up that way, and then also lock it inside.
Inside of a locking case, a cabinet. You know, you think for the majority of people that can afford guns, guns are expensive tools to have.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can afford that, think through responsibly how those are locked up. You know, you hear stories all the time. People have guns stored away in you know, under the car seat. They have them stored in the tool chest out in the garage or the woodshed. And it seems like, okay, you got these.
You think the kid doesn't know where it is, but they know where it is. Kids can find everything. They know where everything is.
Yeah, they do. They can find it. And that's, you know, the data and the statistics show that young people under the age of 17 that die accidentally or even by suicide in the home, 82% of the time, it's with a gun, family weapon, that they were able to get access to.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can prevent that access.
82%.
That's 82%.
So that's the big bite if you could stop that.
That is a big bite.
Yeah.
And so just...
So you kind of alluded to something that I wanted to get into. And
yes.
You brought some material on gun safety rules. It says the 10 commandments of gun safety, and
yes.
10 is crossed out and 11 is added. And a lot of these commandments, if you know anything about your gun, you already know, to get instruction and wear eye and ear protection and make sure your gun and ammunition are compatible and, make sure of your target and don't use mix alcohol and shooting and all these things. But then number 11 is consider temporary offsite storage if a family member may be suicidal. Makes sense, but it's something you're having to add to the list.
Yeah, it's adding to the list, and it's if you've been through a course like that, like in Alaska, you're familiar with those Ten Commandments. That's not one that's been added in Alaska. Washington State, which is our closest state, in terms of proximity, just added that this last year, and we've actually talked with them about the process of how that happens. So, we're hoping to move in that direction even in Alaska. And if you're out there listening and you're like, oh my gosh, you don't want to add one more thing. But the idea is somebody, if they are hurting, struggling with life in your home, during an impulsive moment, you don't want to have easy access to guns. And it's not restricting somebody from the guns, but it's keeping them safe somewhere else. And that's why police departments all over
this. So beyond locking it up, it's locking it up somewhere else.
Somewhere else. Place. So, at the very least, have them locked up in your home. But obviously, an adult, a young person, they can find the keys. So.
Yeah.
Keep them safe either with the police department, which is a viable thing. Anchorage Police Department will keep your guns. It doesn't cost anything during a short period of time to keep them safe. State troopers, some different groups around the state. Or with a friend, family member, somebody that – and the best thing is to plan these ahead of time so that it's not during a crisis moment that you're like going, oh, my gosh, what am I going to do with these guns? You can still do it then, but it's not the best time. Be proactive. Like in my family, I have three sons of various ages. And so we sit around and we talk about, if our family was to be in a situation like this, here's what we'll do. And we'll talk about, strategies to help each other out.
We're just starting in our culture to become comfortable with accepting that mental health problems affect virtually everyone at some time.
Yes.
And it's not a matter of like hide it in shame. It's actually like,
yes,
let's deal with it. Let's get the help we need. And then also, as you're saying, stay safe.
That's right. Absolutely. If you look at national data, and Alaska's no different, one in five people in a given year might suffer from a diagnosable mental health issue or substance. And if that's the case, we talk about that. It happens in our life, and we work together to move towards wellness and keeping guns safe.
So do some risk reduction while you're in that process.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And we're not talking about the crazed shooter in Las Vegas. I mean, that's a whole nother area. We're just talking about for everybody.
Yes.
We're talking
about
for regular people.
Yeah.
So if you get a new gun, and people do all the time, you need to learn that gun and maybe go back to class and go through these 11 commandments again. How do you do that?
Well, one of the amazing things is here in the Anchorage School District and some of the other school districts, I think, around the state, they actually, several schools in eighth grade teach hunter education and safety. So that's one way that our kids are able to get an introduction.
I'd like to see. I mean, Alaska, it'd be nice if every kid had that, right?
Because absolutely.
You always, guns are going to come into your life.
Yep. I've had friends whose children have gone through the class at Hanshew Middle School. But also, if you go to Alaska Department of Fish and Game website, they have classes that they're offering every season, and you can actually sign up for those classes online, usually 2 days or multiple days, depending on whether it's evening after work or if it's all weekend. But it's a great opportunity to learn how to use your weapon, kind of the ethics and safety, and they really go over all those preventative strategies when you're out in the field. And accidental deaths are a tragic thing. And so preventing just one of those makes a difference in our society. And that's kind of that public health message, I think, that we want people to share and talk about and be aware.
So sources of information for folks, where can folks like get your stuff or sort of like learn more?
Yeah, so people are welcome to email me at the university.
Okay.
My name's Eric, ERIC, at Alaska CHD, which is the acronym for Center for Human Development, chd.org. And definitely we provide different classes, definitely around mental health, suicide prevention, just to promote overall wellness. And in any of those classes, we talk about gun safety and managing that because it's a part of our life.
Yeah, I'm glad you're doing it.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think that sort of it's one of these things, it's a creating a social norm of what's expected.
Yes.
And the fact that, you know, you're not born being a tough macho guy who knows everything. You might need to go out and learn. And certainly when I bought my shotgun, I went to a lot of effort to make sure that I knew how to use it properly and what the safety rules were and to keep it safe. So thanks, Eric.
Yes.
It's really good work that you're doing.
Thanks. Appreciate that.
Eric Boyer is with the Center for Human Development in the College of Health at the University of Alaska Anchorage. And we'll have links. Go to outdoorexplore.org and click on today's show, and you can find some of that information. So thanks very much. And we're going to now hear another piece, which is not about guns, but about another a weapon of sorts that you might take out into the field in Alaska. This is something that was recorded earlier at the Trail Tales event. It's put on by Alaska Trails, and it's the story of Jason Siemens, who's going to be speaking, a story of something going wrong with bear spray. Yeah, you need to be careful with all of your weapons. So here's Jason Siemens from the Trail Tales event put on by Alaska Trails.
So many of you are probably familiar with the phenomenon of having a friend or an acquaintance from outside, from the lower 48, come up during the summer and visit you for a week while you play host. So this happened to me and to my family in the summer of 2014, it was, with one important difference, and that is that the acquaintance was someone I had never met, but my wife knew, and my wife and family were gone that week. So I was gonna play host to Tony, who I'd never met before, but who was German, and was a graduate student in the Midwest in something I don't remember. But you know, the trails build community. We hear it all the time, and I was like, well, we're gonna show this guy around. So about midway through the week, I thought we should go mountain biking. And he had biked some, never mountain biked, but we went up, I took him to the hillside trails. And for those of you who don't know, the hillside trails are a bunch of single track mountain biking trails in and around Hilltop and below Prospect Heights, so I took him up. It's not far from our house, so we just biked. And we went up the drone lane, then we went up Janice's Jive, and then we went decided to go down the Hive. Actually, sidebar, Janice's Jive is the best name for a mountain bike trail that we have ever had. It's like, am I learning how to dance disco, or am I mountain biking? Anyway, so Tony and I, we start down the Hive, and he's not real fast, so I'm waiting every now and then to make sure that he's fine. I want to be around if he falls or something. So I take a turn around one of the corners in Janice's Jive, and sure enough, I pass a bear. And it's maybe 5 yards away, and I think this is probably the only bear I've ever seen on these trails. And I remember it being brown, but that's probably not true, and I keep telling myself that. So I see the bear. He's largely uninterested. He probably heard me coming, and I don't want Tony to see him and freak out, so I stop maybe 10 yards down the trail. I get my bear spray out. I take the safety off. I start banging my bell and making a lot of noise so that when Tony comes, he can see me and he can tell that I'm there. And I can tell him, you know, get behind me, Tony, and we'll just keep going. Sure enough, Tony shows up, and I say, hey, you know, get behind me. And as soon as he shows up, of course, he sees the bear and his eyes get really wide. And there's this moment where I'm like, is he going to listen to this direction? But he does. He gets right behind me, and the bear, still uninterested, I think, okay, we can probably leave. So I go and I take my bear spray and I put it back in the holster, and I sort of, my holster was right here, and put it right in the holster, right? Just important to put the safety back on. So I sprayed myself from like here to my eye, and I even have this like, in that moment, which time slows down for, by the way, in case you've never been through this, I have this very vivid memory of like watching the spray actually toward my eye. The other thing I realized in that moment, beyond the fact that like 37 years old, I've never experienced that much pain before, was that I really wasn't worried about Tony anymore. And like building community and meeting this guy, not on the top of my list. So I did have the presence of mind sometime after that to think, oh, I should put the safety back on and get that in my holster and put some distance between me and the bear. And about that time, I heard Tony say something like, oh, what is that? because I'd forgotten to warn him what it was. So we turn around and sort of put some more distance between the bear, and I'm like, okay, we got to get down. I want to get home. I want to find out, you know, if I'm ever going to see again, how long I've got to live, whatever. Because I'm pretty sure I'm going to lose the sight out of this eye. So anyway, I'm kind of making my way down the hive, and we actually run into this doctor, and I told him what was going on. He's like, yeah, you should flush your eye out. And I'm like, oh, that's a good idea. But I forgot to tell you, I already flushed my eye out, and it didn't do anything. So thanks for nothing. So we keep going. I'm pretty self-absorbed. I've kind of forgotten to stop for Tony every now and then. And I finally stop. I think it was about the top of Hilltop. Like, I pulled out onto the where the ski area actually is. And I flushed my eye out again. And it actually got a lot better. I think it had only been maybe 30 minutes since I, you know, tried to blind myself. But it was feeling pretty good at that point. And I kind of came out of my shell a little. I got a little less self-absorbed, and I realized that I had no idea where Tony was. I completely lost him. And, you know, there's kind of a maze of trails. So I got kind of worried about that. So I started biking around. I actually backtracked a little. I never saw him. I biked down. I biked over. I biked around. No Tony. I actually ran into that doctor again, and I said, hey, have you seen the German that was with me? And he's like, and he was German? So after a while, I kind of gave up, and I thought, well, I'll go home, and maybe he made his way home, or maybe I can call him. And by the time I actually got home, I should say that the eye didn't hurt as much. My face was still on fire, but I really did want to know if Tony was okay. And sure enough, I got home, and he was there. He'd even gone over to the neighbors and tried to call me. What a great guy. And he wanted to know how I was doing. And I was like, man, what a great guy. And I'm like, I'm doing pretty bad. My face still feels like it's on fire. But in that moment, just like when I sprayed myself, time kind of slowed down, because I realized that even though I didn't really know Tony like 40 minutes ago, he was my best friend now. And like, I talked to him for months after that. I still talked to him. I talked to him about the story. And so a lot of building community, you know, it sounds really great, especially when you're talking about trails, and it is really great, but sometimes it hurts your eyes. Thank you.
That was Jason Sleemans speaking at Trail Tales, put on by Alaska Trails. You can learn more about their organization online. We'll have a link at outdoorexplorer.org. That's all for today's show. Thanks to Omega Smith from the UA Planetarium, who talked about the solstice, Mike Woods on the Susitna River Coalition, and Eric Boyer from the UA College of Health on gun safety. Our producer and Outdoor Explorer is Eric Bork. Assistant producer and booker is Hannah Duro. I'm Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.